What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
If you're going to show up, just know there's work to do. We expect you here for 3-hour practices 3 times a week.
At home, practice. At school, practice. Stop thinking like an individual and start thinking like a team.
Film Spotting is absolutely the most intense competitive dance team I've ever been a part of.
I've never doubted your commitment to Sparkle Motion, Josh. A clip there from one of 2016's standout films, The Fitz, an inventive coming-of-age drama from director Anna Rose Holmer. The Fitz is one of the nominees for the Film Spotting Golden Brick, our annual award for the underseen movie of the year.
This week on the show, we announce the Golden Brick shortlist and more ahead on Film Spotting.
This show is being published and is airing the night that we are taping our live show as part of the Chicago Podcast Festival. I hope it's going swimmingly, Josh.
Somewhere in the future, I'm very nervous.
Because we've been prepping for this live show, we have taken a sort of off week. Of course, here we are producing this show, but instead of doing our normal review and maybe a top five, maybe even a marathon discussion, we're going to look back at some of the films we've discussed this year already that are Golden Brick nominees, and we're going to lay out for you that list of titles that just might win that highly coveted award that we'll announce at our next live show, Friday, January 13th, our 2016 wrap party that will take place here in Chicago. And I suppose we may have some newer listeners to the show who aren't overly familiar with the Golden Brick. It always makes sense to just quickly review the criteria and some of the past winners of the award.
Probably the most prominent piece of criteria is the one you mentioned at the top. These are films that we feel have been underseen or overlooked, largely by audiences. Some of these have gotten critical reviews that are very positive, but just haven't made a huge dent in the marketplace. So that's number one. They do have to have been reviewed and recommended on the show sometime this year by at least one of us. We prefer new or emerging filmmakers. Doesn't mean this has to be their first film, but generally second or maybe third, something like that.
New or new to us.
True. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If they had one or two that haven't made a big splash elsewhere and we haven't heard of that filmmaker, as was the case with one of our previous winners we'll get to here in a moment, then they would be eligible. And then this is a less distinct qualification, but I think we know it when we see it type of thing. It's that the movie shows a formal inventiveness, has a distinct vision. There is clearly some sort of artistic ambition going on that sets it apart.
Absolutely.
So let's review the past winners. This is the 8th year of the Golden Brick Award. Just last year was one of those filmmakers who had a few features under his belt. Sean Baker, new to us with Tangerine in 2015, ended up winning the award. Up next for Baker, a film called The Florida Project, and he has Willem Dafoe on board for that one. Baker is in post-production now on that. In 2014, here's a familiar name, Jeremy Sunier with Blue Ruin. He won. This year, of course, he gave us Green Room, which we reviewed on episode 583 of the show this year. 2013, the Golden Brick winner was The Act of Killing, the documentary, great documentary from Joshua Oppenheimer, who followed that up with last year's companion film, The Look of Silence. We reviewed that one as well on episode 551. In 2012, we went with a title that seems like an outlier when you look at it in context with these other ones, Wuthering Heights from Andrea Arnold. But if you go back and look at the impressionistic style she brought to that literary adaptation, it really does work as a Golden Brick. Arnold, of course, has a new film out this year, American Honey. It's in theaters right now and is also the subject of a recent episode of The Next Picture Show.
In 2011, we gave the award to The Arbor from Cleo Barnard. Up next for Cleo, Dark River with Sean Bean coming in 2017. 2010 was the year of Dogtooth from Yorgos Lanthimos. Up next, The Killing of a Sacred Deer with Nicole Kidman, Colin Farrell, and Alicia Silverstone. We got The Lobster, one of the better films films of this year from Yorgos Lanthimos. That film, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, is due out in 2017, but we've been burned before with Lanthimos, so it could actually be 2019. And then the inaugural winner of the Golden Brick, Duncan Jones, and his film starring Sam Rockwell, Moon. Duncan Jones had Warcraft come out earlier this year, a movie that we both skipped, even though we were also big fans of Source Code, his follow-up to Moon. So probably should give that movie the benefit of the doubt.
I think he's deserved that. Yeah, we need to get around to it.
Yeah, I'm with you there. And we should probably mention that if you're not familiar, the award name, The Brick, goes back to the early, early days of the show, 2005. We reviewed Rian Johnson, he now of Star Wars fame. We talked about his debut film, Brick, and talked about it so much and urged so many listeners to see it that kind of became the model for this Golden Brick Award, is picking out a movie like that that wasn't on a lot of people's radars, certainly didn't play in wide release around the country. And it's always nice when people then largely saw it because of our urging. So that's where this all comes from.
Can we make it a rule? Do we have the authority where everyone who's going to see the next Star Wars film has to see Brick first? Maybe everyone high school age and up. Like, if you want to see it, you need to earn that right by going to see Brick.
I love it. Let's make it happen.
You won't regret it.
I don't know how we make it happen, but let's do it.
All right, we're going to announce the complete Golden Brick shortlist later in the show, but let's get started with our first Brick candidate, The Fitz, director Anna Rose Holmer's debut film. We reviewed The Fitz on the show back in July.
You trying to do Brick your wrist?
What do you care?
Dang, dancing must really got you weak. Dang. Hold up. Come on now, Tom. What's wrong?
I'm scared.
Scared? Scared of what? It's all in your mind. Trust me, they gonna get better.
In an alternate universe, there's a different version of the Fitz Adam that would win mainstream audiences' hearts and possibly Academy Awards. The movie follows Tony, an 11-year-old girl boxer played by newcomer Royalty Hightower, who joins an all-girl competitive dance team at her local community center. This could have gone the broadly inspirational route, maybe an indie Rocky for our less gender-rigid age. That's clearly not the film first-time feature director Anna Rose Holmer wanted to make, however. Consider the narrative shift that The Fitz makes about a third of the way through. One day at practice, one of the older dancers suffers a seizure, shaking and sputtering uncontrollably. A few days later, the same thing happens to another girl, and then another. Parents and city officials launch an investigation into the community center's water supply. Tony's friend notes that it's only happening to older girls and wonders if it's some kind of, quote, boyfriend disease. For Tony, these Fitz come to represent another fearful rite of passage, one that she may have to face on her way to adulthood. I admire the bravery of this maneuver. In fact, I think it's the sort of bold ambition we look for in a Golden Brick candidate, which, spoiler, I hope the Fitz will be when we narrow down the final list for our annual award. How did you respond to this shift, though, Adam? Do the Fitz and the Fitz add another layer, thematically and aesthetically, to the movie, or did you find them to be a metaphysical distraction in a film that perhaps should have stuck with the low-key naturalism with which it begins? Hmm.
There's a lot to unpack there, Josh. Beyond, I think, whether it adds another layer or if it detracts in some way, we can talk about just what the word metaphysical might mean as it applies to this movie. And my basic definition, I guess, talking about something that falls outside of the realm of human understanding or what we understand humans to be capable of. There is a moment late in the film that I think undoubtedly applies, and it's a moment I really like. The actual Fitz, you could certainly argue that the movie is ambiguous about, but not even remotely, let's say, supernatural. I think Holmer here allows for physical explanations for what we're seeing, even if she never ventures any such explanations. One of the strengths of the movies, I think. So I don't really see it as a question of whether this ambiguity elevates it or takes away from it, because if you think about it, without it, there's really kind of no movie. It's, I think, the foundation of what is otherwise a very slim narrative. This is more or less a short story. In my view, one that's really vividly rendered, and it leads to, like a lot of short stories do, an epiphany, ultimately, at the end. So for me to pass judgment on how Holmer navigates that ambiguity, it's fundamentally, I think, a judgment on the movie itself. I'm completely buying what she's selling here.
Nice. Good to hear. I think one of the wonderful things about the film is that it is on that line that you're describing and doesn't choose a place to come down. This could have been, you know, a very low-key slice of life drama. But I think the ambiguity that she brings to it, that's clearly the guiding principle. You get the sense like this is why they wanted to make the movie, is to make this leap, whether you feel like it's a big leap or you know, just a little step out into something a little more bizarre. But I think it's stranger than maybe that description you gave sounds. Consider the scene where Tony and one of her friends stick around in the community center after everyone else has gone home. Mm-hmm. And they're running around, checking out the different rooms, having fun. And then they go into the gym where they practice. And a few of these seizures have taken place. And it's very dark. And all of a sudden, you get the sense that this is a ghost story, maybe, or there's definitely a supernatural vibe there. The girls are scared for understandable real world reasons. It's a big, dark place that they're all alone in and that they're not usually at by themselves. Mm-hmm. But also add to that the layer of whatever is going on, this mystery that's going on. And I think this is a very cleverly constructed film in so many ways, including the sound design, which is maybe the one element that gives it a real flair of horror to me. I mean, there are these, if you listen to the background, and this happens very early on before mm-hmm. we get any hint of weirdness going on, there's slow rumbles, there are these threatening rattles, and then this one long horn almost that will repeat that really puts you on edge and hints that there is something else going on here. So you're right. It's a short story in that the metaphor is right there, given to you right away. You know that adolescence is coming and she's unsure of that. She's not sure of where her body is taking her or this major decision. Should I stay with mm-hmm. boxing or should I join the dancing? Where am I going to take my body? It's a pretty simple thing, but by delivering it with such ambiguity and enticing details and atmosphere, I think Holmer and her collaborators capture adolescence as an out-of-body experience, mm-hmm. which seems obvious, but I haven't seen many other films depict it that way in quite this way.
Yeah, maybe I didn't feel that same sense of kind of supernatural dread, though I did often feel a little bit of dread, but maybe not as pronounced as you just because of the performance. And I think Hightower's performance is great. I'm sure we'll talk about it. But she's so unfazed about these things. We see it in her actions, but not in her behavior necessarily or in just her immediate physical reactions to things. She just takes this all in and we don't really know how she's processing it until she performs some action that then finally displays that. But where I'll support you completely is there are two movies I kept coming back to or keep coming back to as I think about this movie, one on my mind as I was watching it, one on my mind later as I was thinking about it and thinking about what I think is so remarkable about it. And the first one is actually The Witch. And I was going to note how different the two movies are from a content standpoint, right? This is mm-hmm. a movie set back in, what, the 17th century, the 1600s?
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, long time ago. And this Puritan society, a family cast out, and it is decidedly supernatural. We definitely see those elements come through. But then it occurred to me, Josh, that they're not that different. The primary character in both is an adolescent or a teenage girl dealing with a new environment, confronting new desires. They're both on that fragile precipice of discovering who they are as young women. And so that's there. But take it a step further and take it back to the metaphysical. There's a certain hysteria that takes hold there.
Yes.
In the fits, just like it does for the family in The Witch. What I was thinking on a much more basic level, though, is all the same phrases that I heard you and Michael Phillips use when you were praising The Witch as one of the top five films of the year so far apply for me here in terms of the director's control of tone and mood through building that subtle sense of dread, the way the camera moves through these halls, how it frames and how it shows the perspective of the main character, the pacing of the edits. And you talk about the sound design with you completely. I think maybe even more provocative is that terrifically unsettling score by Danny Bensi and Sondra Juryens. you're so right. Everything we talk about in a Golden Brick contender is on display here. Clear directorial vision, artistic ambition, though here on a relatively modest scale. This isn't the other movie I was thinking about, but as I was jotting down my notes, it reminded me a little bit too of The Neon Demon and conversations about that film, where I think this is largely an exercise in style, like that movie is, but it's so well executed that the style ultimately creates substance. All the meaning is derived from that style.
It is amazing what Holmer manages to do with this really mundane setting. We hardly leave the community center, mm-hmm. and it's these are gyms, these are hallways, these are locker rooms.
I'll say I was confused and actually thought it was really a school, a big school with a lot of different rooms and a boxing ring and those kind of things. But it could be either place because we just really never get outside it.
We don't. And it's they're such familiar spaces. But her choices of when to go widescreen mm-hmm. and allow the actors who are all athletes in some way to use all that space and move, or the times to go claustrophobic, like in the locker rooms, are really key. And she makes this a visually striking film without having to find a setting that will help her do that. So she brings it all out mm-hmm. in the choice of the camera work. I love the witch comparison, which did not come to me at all, but that is so good, especially the two climaxes.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to spoil all this, but you make that comparison, and maybe we can just say that what is in common there is perhaps this idea of possession. Mm-hmm. Let's just tiptoe around it that way. And that brings to mind another point of comparison I had in this film, and it was actually Beyoncé's video for Formation that came out just at the time of the Super Bowl. It also involves a competitive dance team. And I think if I remember right, it's been a while since I saw it, but there are sequences in an emptied swimming pool. Maybe this is coming from Lemonade, too, that I'm thinking of, but dance sequences in an emptied swimming pool, which also occur here. So you have that, but you also have this idea. There are church scenes in Formation of the Pentecostal and charismatic tradition, this understanding of being slain in the spirit. So it's being, you know, giving your body over to the Holy Spirit and results in seizure, mm-hmm. seizures, convulsions. And that is a thread here, too, that I don't think Holmer is necessarily pushing very hard, but it's yet another one of these ambiguous possibilities that's going on. And I love how the movie plays with that in the end. And I don't know which might have come first, the conception of this film or the Formation video, but there are such clear echoes along these lines between the two that I like how they do speak to each other. Mm-hmm. Hightower's performance is the one thing I was trying to, you know, child performances are so difficult, and she's absolutely arresting. There's no doubt about that. But this is distinct in that the movie doesn't draw much force, I would say, from her personality
no.
or her performance. As you said, she's
an
observer.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's absolutely true. There's not a lot of dialogue in this film
no.
overall, and she doesn't get much either. Yet we're drawn to her, and I think it is because she has a presence,
yeah.
so you do have to give her credit for that. And the opening scene of her doing sit-ups where she comes into focus mm-hmm. as she comes to her knees and looks right at the camera,
mm-hmm.
there's a boldness to that that
yes.
I think hooks us. So she has that. But I also think it's in Holmer's decision, again, to focus this movie primarily on bodies. And
mm-hmm.
then this ties into the out-of-body idea as well. But we see so many things like just close-ups of feet skipping rope, or the girls dancing in a middle shot where it'll get aggressive and they'll almost like attack each other with a dance
yeah.
move. And that echoes boxing, right? So you can see why Tony is intrigued by this. It's
mm-hmm.
not necessarily because it's girly, but maybe because it's competitive
yeah.
in that way. So I do like her decision to really focus the camera on bodies and how they're being sometimes measured and changed. There's a shot, there's a great edit here, and I forget now which comes first, but I believe it's the boys being weighed for their next boxing
mm-hmm.
match, and a quick cut, and maybe it's the reverse of this, sorry if I'm getting it wrong, but a quick cut then to Tony being fitted for her dance costume.
Right.
And it's again this idea of, you know, controlling bodies, her letting her body change in a way that maybe she's not sure of. And I just love all the little touches that the movie finds to emphasize that.
Yeah, I'm with you. And the other movie I was going to mention as we're talking about echoes here, and I really don't think it's about reference points in the sense of Holmer trying to reference these movies or necessarily being inspired by them, but in terms of me processing why this movie works so well for me, it really made me think of Under the Skin as well. And Sam and I were talking about this, and he mentioned how that's another film that made similar use of its score.
Yes.
To always keep you a little bit unnerved. And I agree completely, but the real connection for me is in how Jonathan Glazer in that film and Homer here use point of view. And yes, there is this ethereal quality too. There's something a little bit otherworldly about both films and about both stars. But we start to see and experience the world in Under the Skin through the alien perspective of Scarlett Johansson's character. And I think Tony is kind of like an alien too. This gets to your out-of-body notion, right? She's kind of like an alien in this world of these older, more mature dancers who are all doing things that she can't do just yet or isn't quite capable of, but has a certain longing to. And you've touched on this a little bit, but she's frequently isolated in frames. And there are a lot of close-ups. That opening is an example where she's coming up to the camera doing sit-ups. The background behind her, very blurred. We don't really see what's going on. We know that some people are boxing, but they're not very distinguishable. So there's this really use of shallow focus. And it's often straight on with Hightower filling up the whole frame, looking at us as if the camera is her mirror. So we instantly start to develop that identification with her. And just some examples of how that identification then really takes hold. When she's in the locker room, that first locker room scene after dance practice, we hear what she's hearing based on where she's sitting. Mm-hmm. We see what she's seeing based on where she's positioned. At one point, she's changing in a stall instead of out in the room. She goes into the stall, and she's kind of eavesdropping on two of the older girls, I think two of the captains of the dance team, and we see them from her perspective through that slit in the door. And so I just think that heightens that connection to her, where we become not only connected but invested in everything she's going through because of how the camera positions her. It becomes a sort of symbiotic relationship between us and her, where our experience, as I said, is heightened because we experience the world the way she is. You mentioned how there's an investigation going on in this film. It almost makes it sound like that's a real plot element. It's not.
It's like a reference.
It's alluded to.
It, yeah.
It's referenced, but the way it's referenced is at one point the dance coach is explaining to everyone in the room, maybe they shouldn't drink the water or hear some new developments. But because the camera is by her and because we hear it as she would hear it and we're paying attention to it just as much as Tony is paying attention to it, it is never given any more focus than that. It's all about her and how she's experiencing it. And it's not ever about those plot machinations. So that for me is really what captivated me about this movie. And as I've said all that right before I came in here, Josh, I caught a line from the critic Bilge Abiri from The Village Voice, and he said in his opening line, in Anna Rose Holmer's The Fits, emotion becomes motion and psychology becomes space, which I think so eloquently and so poetically sums up everything you and I just spent about 7 minutes saying. He nailed it there in one sentence.
That's it. That's why there isn't a need for dialogue. More dialogue in this film would be redundant. Another example of what you're talking about Tony being a figure apart, is when she's in the halls. This is more towards the beginning. How much, how frequently is she moving in one direction and then a flood of the dancers will come out in the other direction?
And they're celebrating and they're cheering or doing whatever.
In her demeanor, in her direction, she's very different. So my favorite scene in the film.
Oh, yeah, I know
I
where you're going.
Get to,
I got to know where you're going.
It's hard to say because the climax is just so ecstatic. I mean, it's exhilarating.
Yeah, but
but it's on the bridge.
There's a breathtaking scene, the overpass.
Yeah, she goes to this overpass. It's caged. It's a long take, but very delicate use of when to move in. And this, again, goes to this idea of transition.
Mm-hmm.
Tony
the transition.
Yes. Tony starts doing jumping jacks, which are part of her boxing routine on this bridge. And then suddenly it sort of morphs into the dance routine that she's been learning. And just as she starts doing that, this clicking, the rhythmic clicking on the soundtrack comes on and the camera slowly moves in on her. And at first you think, no, don't do this because we want to see her whole body in motion. That's what you've been doing all along. Mm-hmm. And you know, she's starting to perform this routine. We want to see how she pulls it off. But then I noticed the closer we got, one thing we get by being that close to her is we see her smile.
I'm so with you on
and
this.
She hasn't really smiled that much. Sometimes with her brother who works at the community center as well, and she has a really close relationship with. That's how she got into boxing, we assume. But really often she's observing again. She's hooded, and she's quiet. And here we get this little smile.
Yeah.
And even describing that, it maybe sounds like it is a rocky moment, like this transformation moment. But it isn't, to me, it wasn't her becoming a dancer.
No.
It wasn't that she now nailed the routine. Because if you notice, her dance moves incorporate boxing moves.
Like, yeah.
She doesn't fit with the team because all of a sudden she'll impulsively let out a punch. And I just love that she brings it.
Yeah.
She's making the dancing her own. So this isn't like she finds a way to become a girl. Really, the end of this movie for me, it doesn't matter. The point isn't what does Tony become through this experience. The point is just that she's transformed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's enough. That's all this movie really needs.
You can really discuss what you make of that transformation and whether we see it as, quote, good or bad. That's mm-hmm. too simple.
Or even what it is.
For sure. Yeah, or even what it is. And I agree with you that that's something that makes this movie so provocative. But so much for me having a unique take on that scene. I'm with you. It's absolutely the standout sequence in this movie. It sounds like we both might be fighting over it as a scene of the year candidate.
I put it on the list.
At our rap show in 2017. But I'll try to add this. It is so wonderful to watch, of course, partly because it's all captured in one take. So there is that element of watching her physicality, which you talked about her performance and the fact that she is often very kind of deadpan, or she's not someone who's reacting in her face or emotionally to what's going on. But there's still something to her performance in just watching her move, through this space, right? And watching her make that transition, that's what's so great about it. It's not just that she goes onto this overpass and she decides to practice and all of a sudden the dance moves click. It's that we actually do get to watch her practicing for boxing. She's running to be in shape for boxing, mm-hmm. as we've seen her do with her brother earlier and at different points in the film. And she naturally, as she is taking swings and doing various boxing practice moves, she just instinctively, I think, transitions into those dance moves.
It's like, what her body wants to do.
Her body,
yeah.
That's it. It's where her body and her mind finally merge. And that smile, I was wondering if you would notice it, because this is what makes it so great. What makes it not be that kind of cheesy moment or a Rocky type moment is Homer never cuts to her face to show us that. She gets closer. Yes, but at no point, once she's figured out these moves and once we recognize that smile, does she cut to a close-up from the front so we can see how joyful she is. The camera stays exactly where it is because that smile is hooked directly to what her body is doing, and it requires us as viewers to be paying attention to notice that bit of elation that finally comes through on her face. So just every right move there with that scene.
That's a remarkable choice to make for a first-time feature director as well. Like you said, to put the trust in the audience and not to oversell the emotional key to the scene at all. So right there, along with the other things you say where you feel like there's such control behind the camera here, yeah, Mark Homer is a hugely exciting talent.
From this past summer, our review of Anna Rose Holmer's The Fitz on the shortlist for this year's Golden Brick Award. The movie is available to rent via most streaming platforms free for Amazon Prime members.
The Golden Brick preview continues in a moment with the complete 2016 shortlist and Adam's interview with James Solomon, director of Brick nominee The Witness. Stay with us.
Holy sisters in circle, children of mine, you humble my heart, sharpen my mind. Though scattered and weary, changes pass, we are bound till the end, still a family, I promise. And all that you love will be taken someday by the angel of death or the servants of change. In a flood water tide without sing loud while you're able, in grief and in praise.
دیدم.
خانه ازام کنن ایلام.
اینجا که درست وسط جنگه.
خودتو بری من میترسم.
نداره عزیزم. تو تا چشم به هم بزنی من برگشتم.
You do not need to speak Persian to be unnerved by that. We get back into our Golden Brick preview with some of the trailer for the Iranian horror film Under the Shadow. This is a film that is not a Golden Brick nominee, Josh, but only because we haven't seen it yet, which is to say, it could very well become one. We are actually taping this preview a bit in advance of when we normally tape an episode, and certainly we expect to see several more movies between now and the time we announce the final candidates in December for the Golden Brick. So before we get to those finalists, we know we have a few more films to see. Under the Shadow is one that has been completely off our radar until we heard from a couple listeners, including Joshua Fenning in L.A.
Just looking at your Golden Brick Award nominees and notice the glaring omission of Under the Shadow, the Iranian thriller slash suspense slash horror film written and directed by Babak Anvari. This film is everything that a Golden Brick movie should have. It's well written, artistically filmed, brilliantly acted, and altogether an original effort by a first-time feature-length filmmaker. Yes, Adam, it is scary. But it is much, much more than that. It's the type of movie that we count on film spotting to hoist on its back and champion to a hungry audience base who would otherwise miss out entirely.
Michael Harrison in the UK agrees. If Under the Shadow hasn't been mentioned yet, it has to be considered for the Golden Brick because we don't have enough to see these days, Josh. Babadookish Iranian psychological horror. Get to it. Michael says.
Okay, that I apologies to you, but that just vaulted it ahead of The Tower on my list of movies to catch up with.
Okay.
Babadook was on my top 10 list, so there you go.
And Babadook-ish is just kind of fun to say. So this is a film that if it played in Chicago theaters, and I think it did at some point, but we completely missed it. It came and went. It's available, though. It is out there. It's on iTunes. It's probably on some other platforms as well. So if you're listening to this and you are intrigued as well by a film described as Babadookish Iranian psychological horror, we hope you'll see it. We hope that you'll write in and tell us if you think it should, in fact, be a Golden Brick finalist. One other film that isn't, as of this moment, Josh, a Golden Brick candidate, but very well could be, because I'm only halfway through it, is one of my most anticipated films of the year, Camera Person, the documentary from Kirsten Johnson. It's really a collage, I suppose you could say, of outtakes of scenes from previous films that she's served as the cinematographer on. This is her first film as a director, and our friend Matt Zoller-Seitz, who has appeared on the show here recently to talk about Oliver Stone, said in his RogerEbert.com review, the collage film Camera Person is one of the most original, challenging, sometimes infuriating documentaries of recent times. He gives it 4 out of 4 stars. So I didn't need to know that to feel really bad about not finishing this film.
I was going to say,
it's going to happen.
Propel you to finish.
It's going to propel me to finish it. Now, before we get into the other films that are, in fact, Golden Brick nominees, along with The Fitz, we thought it'd be fun to take a quick step back and talk about the latest work from a previous Golden Brick finalist. Not the winner last year, beaten out by Sean Baker and Tangerine, but we were big fans of Joel Patrykis's film Buzzard. And Josh, we got a note from Ben Haworth, longtime listener. I could have swore Ben was always in Austin. He's out in North Hollywood, California now. Maybe he's made the jump. I know he is a filmmaker slash editor. He wrote in to say, just thought I'd let you know that Joel Patrykis just put out a new film for free via BitTorrent with a pay what you want model. The release is pretty cool, and I know you guys are a fan of Buzzard. You should check it out. It's a pretty good 80-minute film worth seeing, and it's technically free. Just figured I'd share it with you both. The movie is called The Alchemist Cookbook. We have had this movie on our radar for a while. We've even had the ability to watch it for a while. And again, it's just fallen behind some other priorities. But we are fans of Patrykis. We encourage everyone to check out his work, and we're excited to see it when we finally do. We'll include that link to the film in the notes for the show if you are also curious. So we're about ready to actually get to the rest of the nominees. We have one other bit of business to take care of, which is to lay out some films that listeners might think should have been nominees based on our love for these movies, some of the discussion that's happened surrounding these movies on the show over this past year, but we don't actually think they're eligible. I'll start with the one that I'm a huge fan of. It was my number one film of the year so far when we did that list back in July, the latest from director John Carney. It's called Sing Street. It's out now on DVD. It's available for rental on most streaming platforms. It is his third film, John Carney, following his breakout, which was Once, even though you could argue he's still a filmmaker who is kind of under the radar, certainly not a household name, fits the criteria in terms of the movie being one that I think has been overlooked largely this year, shows a real distinct directorial vision. I'm ultimately with you and with our astute producer, Sam, that he's a filmmaker who could have won the Golden Brick had it existed for Once, and that kind of immediately makes him ineligible for another Golden Brick.
Yeah, though I'm relieved to report, and as you know, I've talked about this, that I did finally catch up with it. It's absolutely delightful. I mean, my agreement shouldn't be a Golden Brick has nothing to do with my enjoyment of the film. It's what I said was it's catnip for those of us who grew up with this sort of music in the background, 80s new wave, I guess you could generally characterize it. We watched it as a family, and the music scenes just went over wonderfully. The performances are so good. So absolutely encourage people to catch up with this if they haven't already. But it is one of those that it's not only Carney's career, but I've had so many people telling me, not just you, to see this as the year has gone on, that it has a very rabid following. Now, the one we're setting aside that hurts a little bit more is one that was on my top five movies of the year so far list, and that is The Witch, Robert Eggers' period horror film. This is one that I saw at Sundance in 2015, absolutely did not know what to make of it, except that I'd seen something blazingly unique. So you have that quality there. Revisited it again when it was finally released just this year theatrically, and man, it just really hit home, and the craft of it is something that stands apart, I think, on its own, but also in the horror genre. But it's really done well.
Yeah, $40 million at the box office, which for a Golden Brick is more than all the other winners and probably most of the nominees combined.
So that success on its own, I mean, you know, maybe if it had opened in November and we nominated it now and it went on to do that, we could, you know, feel like we could celebrate that along with it. But at this point in the game, when it's already made all that money, it does seem like it doesn't make much sense to champion it as an underseen film.
Yeah, and along with the money it made, it was released on over 2,000 screens when it came out. It played at your local multiplex.
Yeah, wide
it played
release.
At ours. So with a wide release, kind of makes the movie ineligible. It has been listed on our Golden Brick page all year, though, since you recommended it. Michael Phillips recommended it. I'm more mixed on it, but I definitely recognize the vision of Robert Eggers there. Love the performances in the film in particular. And in every way other than being overlooked, it's for sure a potential Golden Brick. So that's a tough one to leave out. I'm with you. Now, one that we have a little bit of a disagreement about, and as we sit here right now, we haven't really settled it, though our producer Sam did, as he usually does, come up with a wonderful compromise option, I think, that we might go ahead and take advantage of. But the film that we recently talked about in some detail, we heard my conversation with Barry Jenkins and the movie star Naomi Harris, the film Moonlight is a movie that in every way absolutely is a Golden Brick contender or should be. But as we talk about overlooked, it's not going to make the money that The Witch made. It's not going to get the release that The Witch made. But as we sit here, it's being talked about as one of those 5 to 10 potential Best Picture nominees. And based on the love I've seen it getting, I think it's going to make so many top 10 lists for critics at the end of this year. I just wonder if it truly can be an overlooked film.
Well, I think the distinction for me here is between critic talk and audience reception and the embrace of audiences, because, you know, really the bottom line is to get these films in front of more eyes by nominating them for the Golden Brick. And we're recording this a little bit early, so we're somewhat flush in the Moonlight talk. It just was released in Chicago this past weekend, and so the filmmakers are making the rounds. Critics are seeing it and giving it good reviews. We just don't know yet if that's translated into hugely receptive audiences. It's sort of that witch conundrum.
Right.
You know, it could turn out to become a Best Picture nominee and not a box office juggernaut, but a force. And then we would say, okay, it doesn't really fit. But right now, we don't know that yet. So I don't see the harm in promoting a movie that may not be tiny, but it's still small.
Yeah, and that's really where Sam came out, as he said, look, we are doing this very early at this point. We're not going to announce the finalists until we normally do, which is around that first week, the first 10 days into December. We have some time to see how this shakes out. Why don't we go ahead and consider it a nominee for now, and let's see what type of reception it gets. Let's see if it really is gathering a ton of awards buzz, and if it is, then we can render it ineligible ultimately. So that's where we may come out on Moonlight. Having put out those disclaimers and talked about the movies that we're going to leave off the list, let's go ahead and list the movies that are eligible right now. The movies we've both seen, Josh. We start with The Fitz, the movie we replayed our review of earlier in the show. It is available on most streaming platforms. It's another one that's free for Amazon Prime members if you are one. So no excuse not to catch up with The Fitz if you're going to play along with these Golden Brick contenders.
Krisha is one that you saw early in the year,
right?
And I recently caught up with. The director is Trey Edward Schultz, and it's a very harrowing, almost entirely first-person movie from the point of view of a 50-something, would you say, maybe early 60s, mm-hmm, woman who is returning after a bout of addiction of some kind to have Thanksgiving with her extended family.
Been estranged from her family for a little while.
And man, is this thing intense.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the boldness of its vision is, again, that first-person sensibility, mm-hmm, which it absolutely drowns us in some portions, and then steps back in others. And I'm still trying to work through how much I almost feel like this would be the quintessential Golden Brick if it had never stepped back. Does that make sense?
Well, like, no, I don't know how you feel like it steps back.
Well, there are those scenes where it's almost as if the camera has taken over her, it's in her head, mm-hmm, you know, where what we see is what she sees. And there are sections of that, or even the opening unbroken shot where it's right
Wonderful.
Behind her
mm-hmm
head. And then when it does step back out of that and looks at her a little bit more as the family members might.
Right.
Now, I'm glad for that relief.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could take an entire film that was that close,
sure,
but that would have been another level of ambition.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I like that perspective, and I love the rawness still of that perspective and those performances that we get. But I'm glad that you are on board with Krisha as a nominee. Now, I know you're not completely on board with this film, but we think it does fit the criteria, and we're going to mention it. We split on the movie Morris from America from director Chad Hartigan. We reviewed it on episode 601, again, out on DVD, available to rent on most platforms. And Rams, we've never had a movie that's been part of a marathon be eligible for the Golden Brick, but Rams, as we see it, is technically a 2016 film. That one's streaming on Netflix and available in a lot of places. Grímur Hakonarsson, the director of Ram. So those are our first four candidates, the movies that we both have seen. Now, I guess I've been a little bit busier watching obscure films so far this year, Josh, and I have a few other candidates that I want to highlight. Born to be Blue, the Chet Baker biopic with Ethan Hawke as Baker from director Robert Boudreau. Southside with You, the Obama's first date movie from director Richard Tanna. The Phenom, more Ethan Hawke, directed by Noah Bushell. Paul Giamatti and Johnny Simmons star in that. And Tower, directed by Keith Maitland, the documentary that recreates the 96-minute ordeal that started with Charles Whitman going to the top floor of the tower at the University of Texas and opening fire. You can see Born to be Blue and The Phenom right now most any place that you get rentals. Southside with You is not set for a DVD release until December 13th, and Tower is currently in theaters. I am not sure what kind of DVD or streaming release it's going to get, when that might happen, but we will link in our show notes at filmspotting.net to the list of showings. On the Tower website, they do lay out exactly how that movie is being rolled out to theaters across the country. So four more candidates there for the Golden Bricks, and we will list all of these titles on our Bricks page at filmspotting.net.
We do have one more for the short list. It's The Witness from director James Solomon. Adam, this is one you caught up with, a documentary you saw back in July. You also had a chance to interview Solomon. The movie reexamines the 50-year-old Kitty Genovese murder case by following Genovese's brother Bill in his effort to come to terms with the murder, specifically the infamous claim that 38 people witnessed the murder and did nothing to stop it.
We'll revisit my conversation with Solomon in just a moment. But first, Josh, you did just catch up with The Witness. Whatever else you might have thought about the movie, can we agree that Bill Genovese is one of the great documentary subjects in recent memory?
I don't know about that.
No.
Well, here's the difficulty I have with these very personal documentaries. I think I go back to my reporter days and I see them through that lens. And I think about taking a real world event and trying to mine it not only for the facts, as this documentary very compellingly mm-hmm. does. I think that was the most gripping part for me, was its exploration of journalism in this case, really a test case, but also to frame a personal arc around it. And I have to say, I felt The Witness straining to do that in the case of Genovese. And
really?
And this isn't to question his it's not at all to question his motivations or the emotions he expresses or the trauma that he's processing. That's not what I mean at all. But in the film's attempt to form that into a documentary narrative, and the way it used his family members and had them stand beside him and almost be supporting characters in his mm-hmm. trauma.
What's there, the there problem was with just, that?
There was just something forced about the formulation of it that, I don't know. Again, looking at it from the journalist's perspective of trying to make that story work for what you want the film to do. And I know this is a film that was worked on over a number of years.
Yes.
And so the different forms it might have taken and how to bring it to closure, there was just something there that held me back a little bit. Now, to go back to the way the movie, and here's where it uses its most, it's really, it's only golden brick quality, not only aside from, you know, being a new mm-hmm. filmmaker, emerging filmmaker, is its use of animation, which is so inventive in recreating witnesses' accounts mm-hmm. and the various
the
witnesses'
of
accounts
night.
Of that night. And not only giving us factual information, but also different perspectives is very interesting and very artfully done. And the way this explodes the myth that was created, the
right.
media myth
yeah.
around this murder is just jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I would have been happy with that alone, even though I know for you and a lot of others,
yeah.
it's the personal element that,
sure.
that they find most compelling.
Yeah, and I think when I asked that about Genovese being a great documentary subject, I don't even mean really in terms of the form of the movie or the narrative that's constructed, but just as a human being, he seems like one of the great people in terms of being able to deal with this tragedy in his life, to seek some kind of closure, to be still such a rational, reasonable, sensitive,
he's very calm.
Intelligent human being. He seems like the kind of guy I would like to spend some time getting to know better. I'm grateful for the time I got with him here in this film, and I'm grateful for the time I had with the director of the movie, James Solomon, who does certainly feel the same way I do about Bill Genovese as a documentary subject. He also talks about his innovative use of animation, as Josh touched on, and how to know you're done making a documentary that takes so many years to make. Here's that interview.
Exactly what was it you heard?
Save me, save me.
Didn't this frighten you or shock you?
No.
I was 16 when my sister Kitty was murdered in New York City. For years, I avoided the details of that night, but it's worse not knowing the truth.
James, my first exposure to the Kitty Genovese murder was actually in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, which I think I read maybe 10 or 12 years ago. He spends just a page or so on it. And without getting too much into it, it's fascinating to reread that part after seeing your movie, because it becomes clear that Gladwell perhaps draws the right conclusion from the case, but as your movie shows, he might have based it on largely false information. When and how did you first become aware of this case?
Well, I'm a New Yorker, and it is such a seminal New York crime. 38 watched, no one helped. That basic narrative came to define New York City in many respects, beginning in the mid-1960s. And it sort of defined New York as this cold, heartless place, and cities in general. I'm sure Chicago bore the brunt of it as well. And so that's a story that you sort of grew up knowing. I was born the year after Kitty was murdered, so I didn't actually live through it, but I certainly grew up knowing about it. It wasn't until the late 1990s when there was an effort to reprint Abe Rosenthal's seminal account, 38 Witnesses. That's what it was called, 35th anniversary, that I actually began to really consider it as a possible basis for a screenplay. And I am by profession a screenwriter and often drawn to stories, iconic stories we think we know. And so that was the inception for me.
This is Bill Genovese's story. It's deeply personal. You're following him, following the trail of this case. So he's driving your narrative, but he isn't the storyteller, or he isn't the only storyteller anyway. How did you get involved with him, and how did you navigate that line between collaborator and filmmaker, and in your own way, witness to Bill's story?
Well, it's a good question. While developing a screenplay based on the iconic, the story that we all know about Kitty Genovese in the late 1990s, I set about, and this was a screenplay I was going to write in collaboration with two others, Joe Berlinger, the wonderful filmmaker, and Alfred Ury, the great playwright. The three of us had pitched to HBO a scripted film based on that iconic story. And so in the process of researching for that film, I met a number of people who were deeply and dramatically impacted by not just Kitty's death, but also her life, having known her. And what's striking immediately when you begin to research this, and particularly at that time, was how few people who were the most directly impacted, either by her death or life, had been heard from. That many, for decades, including Malcolm Gladwell, Freakonomics wrote about this, had opined on this story, but the people who were actually the most directly impacted had been silent. And I met Bill Genovese at that time, and the few things happen as soon as you meet Bill. One, and it takes about 2 minutes to experience it when you see it on film, that Bill is rather singular, an extraordinary guy, and what he's overcome in his life is really, truly remarkable, and the way he's overcome it. I think anyone who just watches the first few minutes of the film will experience that, as I did when I met him. But two other things sort of happen. One is that when you meet Bill, you meet Kitty, and we all know Kitty for the last half hour of her life. So to experience her life through Bill, because he was so close to her and he's able to sort of bring her alive. And the other thing that struck me, and I didn't realize at the time just how profoundly that story of the iconic story had impacted Bill, but he said to me at that time, I needed to prove that I would not only have been someone who opened the window that night, but would have gone down into the street. That's what he said to me in the late 1990s, and this was before there was any real question of the accuracy of that original story of bystanders not doing anything. That scripted project, nothing came of it. And in 2004, the New York Times, on the 40th anniversary of the murder of Kitty Genovese, revisited its own story and published an article in which they questioned whether, in fact, their original account had been accurate. That was the catalyst, and because Bill had been so deeply affected by that story, he needed and wanted to find out for himself what actually happened, and he allowed me to document that journey, which, as you point out, it took about 11 years.
So what was that collaboration like then in the physical process of shooting, where there are certain agendas you might have in terms of trying to get something in the can or explore a certain idea? And then, of course, he may have his own direction that he's trying to go. Did you ever have any issues with that?
Well, I think I learned very early on that there was a reason why people had maintained their privacy, secrecy, held on to their experiences for decades in relationship to this story, largely because a lot of what they had experienced was they were either felt guilt about or anger, or they were deeply private. And I began to understand that really it was only through Bill that individuals would be willing to open up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a variety of reasons. He was so close to Kitty, and I think some people, particularly the witnesses that Bill found over the course of the 11 years, the witnesses in the apartments, they felt they owed it to Kitty to sort of share what happened in the apartments that night. And I think Bill being so close to Kitty is essentially a surrogate, but he's also somebody who has a really extraordinary ability to make people comfortable.
Yeah.
And that is in part a function of his disability. He has been a double amputee caused directly or indirectly, but very profoundly by that story of 38. And the experience of having had that disability since he was 19, and he said to me very early on, people are generally uncomfortable around somebody with the disability that I have, and I put them at ease.
Hmm.
And I think he put so many of the people that he talked to at ease. And I think also, and this is really perhaps the most consequential part of it, is that Bill's understanding of trauma, physical and emotional, has made him, in a sense, uniquely able to understand other people's.
Yeah.
And so they were willing to open up to Bill.
Do you think you were one of the 38 that were reported to have done nothing?
I suppose I could be. I could be counted in with that.
Mm.
I woke up.
Yeah.
I looked out the window and I went back to bed. But I wasn't in that group. That was not my behavior in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In my research, your name and your mom's name is down there as saying, I heard George, George, he's done it to me. George, he's done it to me twice. And then please help me. So you and your mom, you were probably counted as part of the 38.
To your original question, which was the relationship between a filmmaker and a subject, in this instance, it was extremely intimate, but I'm sure for so many documentarians, it's the same. We had a very skeletal crew. I knew that the people that had remained silent, most significantly was Kitty's own family, who had not talked about their experiences for a half century, were doing so on a leap of faith. And I made a choice very early on that I was going to follow and be patient. Bill's journey, which is a screenwriter where you can write yourself in and out of scenes, is something that isn't, you're always not so patient. As a documentary filmmaker, clearly you wait and allow things to unravel as they happen. And certainly the way this journey unraveled was a shock to me and I know to Bill.
Maybe jumping off of that nicely here, we came into this segment with a clip from the movie. It's where Bill's brother, one of his brothers, is asking him when enough will be enough. When is this going to end? And you just were talking about being a screenwriter by trade and you're used to dictating how the story is going to go. If Bill doesn't know exactly what closure and resolution he needs, then you don't really know what closure or resolution your film needs either, I imagine. And I figure that could be daunting, exhilarating, or both.
Yeah, well, I think you just nailed it. It's both. It's absolutely unsettling in good and bad ways. You know, the question that his son Matthew asks of Bill, you know, when is it going to be over, is a question I certainly asked myself on many, many occasions. The film is in many respects sort of serial-like, sort of multiple investigations. One, Bill is trying to find out the answer to something that has fascinated people for decades. What happened in the apartments that night? He also then, as he begins to realize that story, this iconic story of Kitty's murder is deeply flawed, he begins to examine the genesis of that story, how it came to be. But there are also other mysteries that he's unraveling. Who was Kitty? This person that he only knew in a certain way. And who was this person that killed his sister? Why would Winston Mosley have done what he did? So all of these mysteries Bill is sort of pursuing, and in a certain order as he tries to unravel multiple truths. But as the film sort of pitches or turns in a certain way, what Bill is also chasing is these sort of unanswerable questions of life, sort of the why. And only in the middle of making the film did I begin to have a sense and understanding, and largely because of personal experience, that some of the questions that Bill was seeking the answers to were those kinds of questions that all of us seek, and at times it's almost impossible to get at the answers to.
Yeah, without a doubt. My co-producer, Sam Van Halgren, who has also seen the film, we both loved it, and one of the things we were discussing is how the movie is ultimately so profound, probably because it doesn't seem to know how profound it is, or if it does know, and if you as a filmmaker know, you were at least able to not try to spell those themes out, some of which we'll get to, but just let Bill's story unfold.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, I think it's there are sort of tangible questions that Bill is seeking in the very beginning, which all of us would be curious about. What happened in the most, start with, what happened in the apartments that night? Why didn't people act, or did they act? That's sort of a fundamental question, which I think is partly why this story has fascinated people for so long. And for Bill, there's a deeply important reason why he needs to know, because that story shaped his life and his family's life in so many ways. But where it leads him is into a far deeper place of not what just happened in those apartments, but who are we and how do we come to be? What kinds of stories do we tell ourselves over the course of our lives or in the middle of the night that shape who we are?
Yeah. And that's one of my favorite themes for movies and for art in general to explore. I think that's one of the reasons I connect so strongly to the material here. It is about, and it's about many things, as you've touched on, but it's about our obsession individually and collectively with myths, our need for stories that help define for us who we are. This idea of the 38 witnesses who watched and didn't help fed a sense of the worst of who we are and who we maybe should be. And the horrible notion of so many people being unwilling to get involved and help, as you noted, drove Bill to be active and not passive. It actually drove him to enlist to go to Vietnam rather than avoiding it or waiting to get drafted. So was that something specifically you wanted to explore or knew you were going to explore going in, or did it emerge while filming?
I mean, I honestly didn't have any idea in what direction the narrative would take itself. I just knew the starting point where Bill started in 2004, and that was this story that we'd all come to know that was credited with leading to the 911 emergency system, to Good Samaritan laws, to neighborhood watch groups like the Guardian Angels. But this seminal story, taught in sociology classes, peers in, as you point out, Gladwell's book and Freakonomics, 3 months ago was the centerpiece of an episode of Girls, and a month before that, the centerpiece of an episode of Law & Order Special Victims Unit. This story, which has exerted such a hold, may not be true, and it had a profound effect on not just our consciousness, but more importantly, on the family. And yet, in the course of Bill's journey, he uncovers, reveals, learns that the kitty didn't actually die alone. This story of urban apathy and indifference actually has a hero after all. A woman named Sophia Farrar, who was Kitty's neighbor, in the middle of the night, rushed out in her nightclothes down a rear alley, having no idea who was outside, and then pushed her way inside a vestibule, having no idea who was inside, and found Kitty and cradled her in her arms, and it was in her arms that Kitty died. Now, it wasn't just that none of us knew it. The family, Bill's, Kitty's own family, did not know this. For decades, they thought their daughter or sister had died alone, and she had actually died in the arms of a friend. Now, that alone raises questions about that story, but also profoundly impacts the way one begins to think about choices one in Bill's own life, choices that he made. And that becomes almost a launch point to sort of find, well, this story isn't what it was said to be, this iconic story. Why? What happened? How did it come? And if it's not true, what does it mean?
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're talking with James Solomon, the director of the great new documentary, The Witness, which opened here in Chicago this weekend. And James, I'm very torn here because as an interviewer, I want to ask you specific questions and I want to ask specific questions about specific choices you and Bill make. But I would very much prefer that everyone listening see the movie knowing roughly the same amount about it as I knew going in. That said, there are two scenes in the movie that provoked as strong a reaction in me as anything I've seen in a while. That kind of visceral hair standing up on your neck feeling where your breath becomes a little bit shorter as you're watching it. And the first one is the scene where Bill meets with Stephen Mosley, the son of Winston Mosley, who killed Kitty. There's so much going on in this conversation. There's one wrinkle we learn at the end of the sequence. I won't spoil for listeners, but there's the kind of tension anyone would expect when two people are sitting in a room, when one is a victim and the other person is a family member of the perpetrator of the crime. There's Bill trying to get something out of this, right? Emotionally, intellectually, from Stephen. We expect that. But there's Stephen also trying to get something from Bill, which is a little bit more tangible, perhaps, and we don't expect that. That raises the stakes of the conversation. And there's a whole lot more of what we were discussing in terms of the storytelling, the self-rationalization and denial. We realized pretty quickly that Stephen and his family are victims too, which is something I hadn't thought of at all as that scene began. These people have also constructed their own set of myths to handle living with Winston's actions. I just have to ask what it was like for you being in that room watching that scene unfold.
Well, there is a sort of a high wire aspect to it, in the sense that you, after a half century, families never met. And Bill, he's the ultimate truth seeker. It's worth mentioning that in Vietnam, Bill was a field intelligence scout, which basically put him always a few days ahead of his platoon seeking the truth. And he has brought that skill set to his investigation. And he's indomitable and will track or seek the truth wherever it leads. And it leads him to meet with Winston Mosley's son, Stephen, as you point out. Now, what's extraordinary in that scene is that having gone into it, Bill had no idea. And it's really not a scene, it's real life. So in that meeting, Bill had no understanding, none, of what Stephen Mosley's own family's perception was of Bill and his family. Mm-hmm. And so what unfolds, as you allude to, is these, in a sense, competing and really conflicting personal narratives that each has of the other. The whole film, in many respects, is about false narratives and the power of false narratives, the way we might hear something in the middle of the night and come up with a narrative that allows us to go back to sleep and not have to call the police or act. Or over the course of a half century, the stories that we have within our families that could be a photograph, could be a quip or an anecdote that kind of shapes the way we perceive other members of our family. And oftentimes these stories are for our own survival, that we need them, whether they're true or not, and we believe them to be true, but we need them to get through the night or to get through life. Mm-hmm. And what you see in this particular encounter between Stephen and Bill is two people with narratives that they have constructed. What's extraordinary about that scene, in my mind, and it speaks to what makes Bill the most remarkable, not character, person, frankly, that I have ever had the experience of telling, describing or portraying a narrative of, is that his humanity comes through. His innate understanding of Stephen Mosley's need for that narrative. Mm-hmm. And rather than bludgeoning Stephen with the truth, he gently shares it with him.
Absolutely.
And I think it's what strikes so many who see that scene with just how kind and understanding and empathic Bill is in that moment. And he is with everyone over and over again. This is not an agenda film. It's not a guy with a pre-existing understanding or expectation of what the truth will be. He just follows it. And he's dogged and relentless. It is also, and the reason it is not because it's an investigation. This is a film really about, this is a love story. It's a sibling love story.
Mm, yeah.
Bill is reclaiming his sister Kitty's life from her infamous death.
There's also a harrowing scene that follows not too long after that where we get more or less a reenactment of Kitty's murder, where an actress is hired by Bill to portray her and to scream on the street and be out there for as long as Kitty was. And at first I thought that might be kind of a social experiment. And I was very fearful of what the results would be, where maybe it would actually prove that this myth about urbanites being too apathetic and fearful to help would actually be proven true. And of course, then we see that it's not so much about that. There were probably some technicalities that forced you to share what was going on with the neighborhood. It really is more about Bill experiencing it. And I'll just say, I watched this movie at home via a screener link hooked up to my TV. And as I realized what was about to play out, I stopped it for a couple minutes. And I just kind of walked around my living room to prepare myself for it. Obviously not something I'd be able to do in the theater. There's nothing gruesome that happens. There's nothing even shocking. We know how it's going to play out. But even for 10 minutes after, I was really on edge. And I just love for you to talk about the decision to stage that.
Well, now this is a sort of a perfect example. I think you alluded to, Adam, where sort of your audience is going in and they're now getting, you know, in a sense, folks listening are thinking, gosh, I don't want to go see that. And I can understand why, honestly. There is a kind of initial cringe factor, and you're referring to it in a sense, stopping the play button, hitting standby.
I mean, so, that all is a compliment, too, by the way, to the power of the film.
Yeah, no, and I take it that way, and sort of aware of it. So just so your listeners understand, for the past 50 years, Bill has been... Bill Genovese, Kitty's younger brother by 12 years, has been replaying the narrative of what took place that night in his mind over and over again. And I think any of your viewers who have, particularly those who have lost someone early, could be a sibling, could also be a parent or child, replay over and over and over and over again in their mind their loved ones' last moments, last minutes, last months. And Bill has been doing that for very understandable reasons, because this being such a public crime and being such a horrific crime.
Mm-hmm.
Add to that the fact that for 11 years, Bill had been returning over and over and over again to the location where his sister had been murdered in Kew Gardens, Queens. And that block where she was murdered, Austin Street, is exactly, but for the signage, exactly the way it was a half century ago. Nothing has changed. So you were essentially standing on an existing standing set. And Bill, both by being there, has also, in a sense, been experiencing, reliving, and getting as close to that moment as he possibly can, as possibly anyone can. But he's also became very, very familiar with the neighbors and the neighborhood. And so when Bill decided that he would seek to experience as much as he humanly could what it sounded like on the street, and that's what propelled him. So he doesn't hire a Winston Mosley actor. There isn't someone who's stabbing anyone. It's an actress who's recreating the sounds on the street, very different. For several months prior, the city, the local police, the neighbors had all been notified, and we had been filming in that neighborhood for years, so they all knew Bill. And that goes back to my prior point, which is people who appear in the film and the neighbors and the neighborhood only would have permitted and allowed and were willing because of Bill. And so on that, the choice, the decision to recreate, I think, to reenact, as in a sense what Bill went in thinking, I'm paraphrasing Bill, I'm a scientist, sort of an ethologist, I'm trying to understand sights and angles and point of view. I don't think he fully understand just how emotionally immersive and cathartic the experience would be. But throughout his entire lifetime, he's been trying to get as close to Kitty, the person he loved more than anyone, who he describes in the film as a mother and a father to himself. He's been trying to get as close to her as possible, and this was a way that he thought or felt he could get close to her in a certain way. And it was certainly not testing the neighborhood. It speaks to his relentless quest to connect with the person he loved and lost.
Yeah. I was curious as well about your decision to use some animation at various points in the film. I think that it obviously provides some clarity where it's very much needed for us as viewers, but it also provides a creative solution to some visual problems that you have. What was that process like?
So there are lots of documents that Bill gathers over the course of his decade plus. And how do you externalize what Bill is gathering informationally? How do you portray that? And in my mind, the animations were done by phenomenal animators in London called the Moth Collective. And I found their work, a student film that they had made, that one of the principals had made at art school in London on the internet. I was looking for a way of portraying what Bill's gathering of information was in the way to him. And in many respects, when you gather information, it's sketchy. It's not fully formed. It's pieces. It's thin lines, not fully formed either live action or fully formed animation. And so the work that the animators did, and they did a beautiful job, is portraying this notion of pieces of information that aren't fully formed and conclusive. And they're also reflective of his whiteboards, which is what Bill used to gather and to assemble all the information that he was collecting over the course of time. I also, Robert Rauschenberg is an artist whose work I deeply admire, and he uses collage. And in a sense, what Bill was doing was using all these different elements to assemble some elusive truth,
yeah,
whether it's newspaper articles or fragments of information or anecdote or detective reports, trial transcripts, medical reports, all that are pieced together to create, in a sense, a collage of a truth that, as we've talked about, is very, very elusive.
Yeah. My last question for you, James. You touched on how you originally envisioned this as a scripted project for HBO and your background as a screenwriter. If you look at some of the other work you've done, The Bronx is Burning, The Conspirator, these are rooted in historical fact, but they are, of course, dramas. Was making a documentary something you always envisioned doing, and are you going to make more, or was the documentary just the best vehicle for this material?
Well, I'll say this with a sense of, I guess the best way I could describe it is, it's formidable to realize that as a screenwriter, I couldn't and I can't possibly have come up with the scenes that occur in the film the way real life wrote them. And that's rather daunting, honestly, as I go back to trying to write screenplays. There has been no project, no experience I've ever had that's meant more to me, that has been more satisfying and in every respect and more, I think, compelling than the experience of having followed Bill these past 10 plus years. And I certainly didn't set out, as you know, as we discussed, to make a documentary. When the movie opened at the New York Film Festival, Joe Berlinger and Alfred Ury wrote Driving Miss Daisy, and I'm sure all your listeners know Joe's fine work, Paradise Lost, Metallica, fabulous filmmaker, and they both turned to me afterwards and they said, thank God we didn't make that scripted film because the documentary wouldn't have happened. Bill's investigation may very well have, and most likely would have happened, but it would not have been documented. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would want and will want to make documentaries in the future without question. The question always becomes, will the story come along that is as compelling as the one I've been privileged to tell?
Right. It was a privilege to talk with you, certainly to meet Bill on screen and to watch the story unfold. It's a stunning film, and I wish you all the best of luck with it. Thank you, James.
Thank you so much for having me on and for your very kind words about the film, and your program's fabulous. Thank you.
At what point are you going to be satisfied?
50 years later, we're still talking about Kitty.
I can't stop until I feel like it's over.
Yeah,
like,
when is
I'll
over?
I'll know when it's over.
Well, I'm hoping many more people get the chance to see The Witness now. It's out of theaters for the most part, but currently available to stream on Netflix and available for rental on most other platforms. To see the complete Golden Brick shortlist, look for the Golden Bricks link under Top Fives at filmspotting.net.
We'll announce the Golden Brick finalists closer to the end of the year when you'll get a chance to vote for your favorite. And we do usually break this up, right, mm-hmm. Adam? There is an audience Golden Brick Award winner, and then we have a panel between Matt Nelson at Film Spotting SVU,
yeah,
and the Next Show, Picture
Show, Michael Phillips,
and
some other
Mike
guests.
Yeah, so we'll all get together, throw in our votes too, and come out with a Film Spotting winner.
Not only do we have the Listener's Choice winner, but we include that voting in our overall panel. So the listeners do have a say in who gets both Golden Brick Awards.
The winner will be announced then at our live year-end wrap party. That's scheduled for Friday, January 13, and tickets are available now for that. So.
Yeah.
Go ahead and book them.
All the information is available at filmspotting.net. Out in wide release this weekend, Bleed for This, Miles Teller plays Vinny, the Pasmanian devil Pazienza, directed by Boiler Room director Ben Younger. Edge of 17, this is a teen drama with Hailee Steinfeld. David Ehrlich says this, Josh, I love it. Pick a god, any god, and thank them for this movie.
Done.
Wow. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the Harry Potter prequel, also out in wide release. Out in limited release here in Chicago, Christine from director Antonio Campos, one of my most anticipated movies of the year, and another one of my most anticipated movies of the year, Elle. Isabelle Huppert stars in that film from Paul Verhoeven. So definitely some good things to see here in Chicago and in limited release throughout the country. Next week on the show, Hear the Show, we recorded live this weekend as part of the Chicago Podcast Festival.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week comes from Glenn Phillips. It's off his new album, Swallowed by the New. More information is at glennphillips.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.